Welcome to the Roundtables panel this morning. I'm Joe Donahue with an incredible group of, journalists, industry, analysts, experts. What else? Oh, someone's getting a call.
Caught me again.
All right, experts who forget to check their phone off.
Caught me again.
Yeah, now everyone's checking their phones. All right. Hey, Alan Chartok is here. We also have the associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain, and the College of St. Rose, communications professor Paul Conte, former news director of WNYT, and a great pleasure to have you all here. Thank you very, very much for being with us. Very nice. Mike, let's begin. It's Saratoga. It is opening day, and this is always a big news story locally. We can talk about that in a minute of why, but let's just talk about the fact that it is opening day, 150th anniversary, and it's hotter than hell, and now what do you do?
It's not 150 degrees, but it feels like that, I think, to the people in the backstretch. You know, there was some talk about whether they were going to curtail some of the races today, but so far the New York Racing Association is saying they're going to take precautions to keep the horses cool. And I guess there'll be plenty of things to keep the patrons cool as they go up. There'll be beverages and shade and fans, et cetera. And so anyway, it's the 150th year, so it's beginning a lot of fanfare. Everybody is writing about how important Saratoga is. But, you know, while the other thoroughbred race courses in New York, you know, down in the New York City area, are seeing a decline in attendance, Saratoga's been able to keep it pretty good in the last few years.
And summer place.
Yeah, it's a summer place. It's a short meet. It's as some of them are saying, it you know, people go to the Adirondacks, to Lake George for a vacation. They can go to the track one day. It's just part of a whole experience in this part of the state of New York, and it's kind of nice.
Yeah, but what if you were a horse?
Well, it is hot. But we talked to trainers, and Tim Wilkin, who was our turf rider at the Times Union, talked to...
one of the finest, I would
add. Yes.
Turf
I'm sure he'll be happy to hear that, right? But he talked to trainers who said, you know, they're not going to push them as hard this morning when they're doing the training, running around in the early hours. Great photo of them running around yesterday morning on the front page of the Times Union.
You mean the horses, not the trainers.
Right. That's right.
A little bit of both. Running after them, yeah.
Skip Dickstein, the great photographer who just comes to Saratoga every year with so much enthusiasm, has a terrific shot of the horse in training yesterday morning coming around the track at Saratoga. Kind of an iconic shot to kind of set the start of the meet. And, you know, so they'll go a little lighter on them. And if they can just kind of get through today, and maybe by tomorrow afternoon, that giant rainstorm will come and everything will be much better.
Yes, it'll be cooler.
Well, I hope for the horse's sake that they're telling the truth. These guys are doing it a little lighter, and then no horse, you know, gets sick from the heat. I hope that's right. You know, around here, you're not allowed to say anything bad about the opening day. It would be considered
really?
To be un-American.
Well, what do you have to say bad about it, Paul?
I think it gets overcovered.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to, that's what I said we'd get into that, of why it is such a big story. Now, certainly, your former news organization made a huge deal out of it each and every year, which is, I guess, almost, is it required?
No. Well,
I mean, not required. I mean,
at one time it actually was.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
It was connected to the buy. Media buy.
Oh, yeah. I see. So in other words, if they bought it, they said...
They expected that you'd be there opening day wall to wall. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. That is not the case. There's no relationship between our ad sales and the amount of coverage we give the Saratoga track every
I can still
August.
Make them sweat by saying the words car dealer, though.
But we're not talking about that today, are we?
I'm sorry. I must have missed something here. What did you mean when you said car dealer? You mean they make relationships with car dealers?
Nah, just about anybody in the news business, and the words car dealer will will make them sweat, cold sweat.
Well, car dealers complain. They do buy a lot of newspaper ads, and they do complain if you write any kind of an unfavorable article. But, you know,
you do a consumer interest story about somebody who's got a problem, and you'll hear from every single car
dealer. But we still do
dealer.
Them, and, yeah. and we maintain that line between church and state of advertising and editorial. But getting back to the track, I mean, I think there is a time when we should be wretchedly excessive in our coverage. And this is our franchise. This is one of the biggest deals in this region. And when they open, and it's the 150th year, why wouldn't you want to?
Well, I agree with that. But yeah. I do, but you know, I think your term is well taken, wretchedly excessive.
Right.
And if you go right now, if you were at Saratoga and in the clubhouse right now, every major media outlet is on that porch broadcasting live. Every single solitary major media outlet,
with
in the
exception
country,
of WAMC.
I was going to say,
and which brings up a whole other point, sort of what you were going about. You know how it's part of your media buy because it's not part of our media buy. We're sort of the bastard stepchild, getting a credential and a.
Well, it isn't that connected anymore. Just in the olden days, especially with the old Naira, it was pretty clear what was expected. The problems that I have with it is the story doesn't really change.
Never.
You know, if you talk about what the definition of news is, being the unexpected, the horses still run the same direction every year. The one that finishes first wins. People bet on them. People show up in hats today. You know, all
two
of
words,
slogan.
Though.
And now we're doing the hot version.
Okay, economic impact?
Yeah, it has economic impact. Yeah.
Yeah, and how about football?
Well, I mean, you're
but
right.
But that same thing. But throw it's covered the ball, in, catch
or,
the ball.
But, it's not,
but yeah. football stays pretty much confined to the sports pages. The track gets out into the front page of the newspaper, of the newscast.
I will say that when the New York Giants were coming to Albany all those years, did put it on the front page. It was a big deal. You know, we regarded that as part of our franchise and our community identity. You know, I don't apologize for our coverage of Saratoga. It's a big deal. And
I'm not asking you to apologize.
On top of that, no, I know you're not. No. But you know, there's actually not much else going on at this time of year.
Well, that's the other thing, right? Yeah. That's the other thing. So
but if there were.
Well, it has been pushed off the front page probably after the first day that it opens. But, we do curtain raisers on big things, and then we regard that as our role in the community.
Do you have one of those things that you do sometimes on the paper today where it's like a half a page?
Right,
you know,
a three-page wrap or a Stadia. Yeah, we haven't been doing that for Saratoga in a few years. We used to print it on pink papers. It would have the tips and the things. But, you know, it didn't prove to be that popular. A lot of people found it annoying.
I found it annoying.
Yeah, you know, they'd rather read it on the sports page. And now that we're in full, beautiful color, Technicolor, our new press, you know, we can have good-looking presentations on an inside page all through the paper. So we're taking advantage of that, and we don't need to put it on pink paper, you know, to stress that it's just about Saratoga. But, you know, everything is about, you know, trying to be distinctive, and we may go back to that some year.
I always found the coverage, especially the television coverage, amusing because it would be wall-to-wall. They'd all have their vans there. Everybody would be there, and they'd be talking about there were this many people this year at this time. There were this many people that year. It's a down by 1.6%, but they bet more money and all of these things, and they got charts and graphs and everything, and they have the picture and the people there, and they're talking about, as Paul mentioned, the hats and this one, and then and at some point you say to yourself, okay, but who won the Daily Double? Nothing. Absolutely
well,
nothing.
That would be in the sports section.
But they don't even have it in there. They didn't even do it. It was like, I thought, well, that's sort of the whole point of this, isn't it? To actually have the races, and they don't even cover that.
Well, Joe, you like to go and place a bet.
I do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have you ever, do you make out? Do you do well?
Do I make out?
Yeah. Well,
have you succeeded?
I think he's asking if you've won money.
Have you succeeded in getting the big jackpot?
I don't gamble a lot.
Oh, because, you know, Mario used to claim that he would bet the fifth horse in the fifth race on every time, you know.
Did he do okay with that?
I have no idea.
Does the governor still have it?
Guys and Dolls? Was that a line?
Yeah, oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. Okay, well,
I don't know if the governor still has a box.
Pataki gave it back. Yeah. And then I don't know. Yeah. I don't know because it was right on the finish line, and I don't know whether they still have it or not.
You may remember that Joe Bruno had a horse issue. You remember that?
Well, yeah, he was a horseman. I mean, he
No. Oh. He had a horse issue. The guy testified in the trial, and that was why he got convicted. Which is the guy said, well, he bought a bad horse, and the reason he bought the bad horse was to make up for other things. Weren't you guys there?
there was at the federal trial, corruption trial that Joe Bruno had about 8 years ago?
Or I don't know.
One of the investments, it was an allegation that he was overpaid for a horse that really wasn't worth it by somebody who also wanted his favor.
Yes. The guy said that.
Yeah. Well, essentially.
Not essentially, he said it.
Yeah.
Okay. So, the beauty of it was that when we came in here that day, we played, Stubby K. I got the horse right here. We played that.
His name is Paul Revere, and the paper says of the weather, it's clear. Can do. Can do.
Yeah.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a break. We'll come back and sing a little more show tunes. We're going to next up the Music Man, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back after this short break.
Support for WAMT comes from Earth Angels Veterinary Hospital, Wappingers Falls, an integrated facility that combines conventional and holistic medicine for a 360-degree approach to veterinary care. EarthAngelsVet.com. Oblong Books and Hudson Valley YA Society, featuring author Phoebe North with her book Starglass. Sunday, July 21st, 4 p.m., RSVP requested, oblongbooks.com. Catskill Mountain Foundation, Hunter, New York, featuring pianist Okutero Fukuma, performing the works of Mozart, Brahms, Debussy, and Albéniz, July 20th, 2 p.m., Doctoro Center for the Arts, catskillmtn.org. And Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, Saratoga Springs, featuring Tilly hats with the UPF 50 sun protection rating and a lifetime guarantee. Seasonal and year-round styles for men and women, wbu.com/Saratoga Springs.
Listen as the wind blows from across the great divide. Voices trapped in yearning, embers trapped in time. The night is my companion, and solitude my guide.
Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel. We have Alan Chartok here as well as Mike Spain and Paul Conti, and we welcome your thoughts as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Big story making headlines across the country about one of our largest cities in this country, Detroit, the cradle of America's automobile industry. Once the nation's fourth most populous city filed for bankruptcy on Thursday, the largest American city ever to take such a course. The decision confirmed by officials after it was leaked in the late afternoon news reports amounts to the largest municipal bankruptcy filing in American history in terms of debt. What brings a major American city to its knees, do you think?
Spending too much money and not taking in enough revenue.
Loss of population, of course.
Yeah. It was 1.8 million in 1950, and now it's 700,000 people. Yeah. That's just stunning.
Kind of sounds like Buffalo, too,
but just
by the
think,
way.
Yeah, your but town. Just think, guys, mm-hmm. if you were a pensioned city worker, and depending on this money for the rest of your life, and they told you, okay, but you're only going to get, I heard this morning, 10 cents on the dollar in terms of your pension. That is a way out for many of these cities.
Right. Will this define what other cities facing the brink will do in the future? Or will it give them leverage to negotiate with their public employee unions? Who knows what the impact of this will be? But I think it will, how it works out in Detroit will play across the country for other big cities like Buffalo, as you mentioned.
They're under state watch. But I'm surprised that bankruptcy courts are allowing municipal governments to declare bankruptcy.
That was a question I had. How does that work?
At least not without more hoop jumping. It's not like a company which has vanquished its assets and is mm-hmm. I mean they the similarity is they have extraordinary debt.
Right.
But they aren't
18
without
billion in this case.
But they aren't without the means to raise revenue.
Yeah, that's right. And they are saying it's Chapter 9, and usually it's Chapter 11 or Chapter 7 for these big companies. So there must be a whole different set of rules. And in fact, in the New York Times story today, it points out that some people are saying, well, you know, the GM and Chrysler went through bankruptcy. Detroit will go through bankruptcy and come out on top. But it's very different.
Yeah, it is.
It won't be that way. You know, it won't necessarily be that way. It would be nice if it were that way. But you know, and what's the federal government's role going to be? You know, they could maybe they can make this a positive model, you know, do what New York State did for when the feds wouldn't help back in 1976, was it, Alan?
Sort of drop dead.
Yeah,
remember
that's
that?
Right. Jerry Ford to New York. Drop dead.
Drop dead.
Famous cover of the New York Daily News.
but Paul raised an interesting point, which is that you surprised about the judge. I don't think the judge has said yes yet.
Right. You're right. He has not.
No, it's not.
Or she has not. I don't know if it's a he or
filed.
She.
But at what point do you say, because I heard this about 40 times last night when I was watching the cable news coverage, which was, well, if we're going to bail out the auto companies, why wouldn't we bail out the city?
Well, that's different, too.
Yes. Well, yes, it is, of course.
It's if they bail out, it would be the same rules. Will they get paid back? The U.S. took a stake in GM. I got paid back.
Right. Well, Detroit pay back Washington.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's
and
unlikely.
That's a big question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. It won't happen.
They're going to expect it as a grant. And then if you do that for them, how many other cities are going to line up and say they want the same thing? I'm not trying to be unsympathetic to the plight, but at some point the writing was also on the wall for Detroit.
For a long time. For almost 2 years, it was debated.
Well, probably before that.
Yes, but as far as with the active discussion about filing for bankruptcy.
But what is it about? Is it just a lack of vision or poor decision-making on the part of politicians where a city like Detroit can be in this terrible state, and yet a city like Pittsburgh, which lost its steel industry and was facing tough times in the 80s, is really hot and doing great? And I mean, what is it that makes the difference? You know, is it just good decision making, or is that it?
Foresight.
Yeah, foresight.
And quality of leadership. I think quality of leadership means a great deal. Who's your mayor? What blocks elect a mayor? What are their expectations? Do the unions own the mayor so that the concessions to unions keep coming? And I think most of the observers on this one think that the union settlements have been
generous.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's somebody was commenting, you know, from a think tank yesterday about it, saying that they basically municipalities and politicians don't want pain. They don't want to inflict pain on people. So they just kick it down the road. And this has been kicked to the end. And now they're facing. But I was surprised to read that over 60 cities and towns across the country have done this. It's just that, in scale, nobody like Detroit has done it. But it's
next in the line, they took $18 million or $1 billion in debt. It may be 20.
Mm-hmm.
And the next one, even close to it, is Jefferson County, Alabama, at $4.2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Both similar populations, around 700,000 people, and both filed within the last 2 years.
Right. Well, if they're filing at $4 billion, maybe Detroit should have taken more radical steps before it got this bad.
Right. Long ago.
You know, when I worked at Rutgers, which was my first job, I had a choice between the defined pension, which New Jersey gives, a regular old pension, and Tia Cref. Which was invented so that you could take it with you.
Portable.
Yeah, portable. I think Tia Cref turns out to be the better choice when you think about it, because the defined pension in Detroit is where it really goes down.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with this story and move on to others as well. We always welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll continue after this short break. Welcome back to our roundtable panel. I'm Joe Donahue, along with WAMC's Alan Chartok, the associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain, and College of St. Rose communications professor Paul Conti. And we welcome your comments as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. We're going to move on to a story that we talked about earlier this week, and that is the cover of Rolling Stone, a cover that shows the Boston Marathon bombing suspect, the surviving suspect, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, in an article entitled "The Bomber." Yesterday, it was announced that chain stores, including CVS and Walgreens, have announced that they will not sell Rolling Stone, and that magazine, that particular issue, will not be available on store shelves throughout the country. Other stores within the Boston area and in the Massachusetts market have said that they would voluntarily not sell the magazine. Governor Deval Patrick, responding to a question from reporters, says, "I haven't read it, but I understand the substance of the article is not objectionable. It's apparently pretty good reporting, but the cover is out of taste, I think." Meanwhile, the mayor of the city of Boston, Thomas Menino, sent a letter to the publisher of Rolling Stone, Jan Wenner, objecting that the cover, quote, rewards a terrorist with celebrity treatment.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. I mean, do you think that portraying him in what looks like a positive light? That same photo, by the way, was prominently on the front page of the New York Times a few months ago. Sure. In a profile that they did of him.
Right.
But to put him on Rolling Stone, where you'll have, you know, rock stars and pop stars and popular people in our culture, and to portray him, I heard somebody say today describe it as that picture was just much too pretty. You know, the mayor has a good point. You know, maybe it just portrayed him too positively and made him a celebrity. But you know, that's kind of one of the points of the story, that he is like so many other people.
I just how stupid do they think people are? Before, I thought this guy was a terrorist who killed people, but now that I see his picture and he's pretty on the cover of Rolling Stone,
he must be a nice kid.
I think I like him.
Yeah, I have a diagnostic question: is did they sell out the edition?
Well, it wouldn't.
I don't think it has hit the stand.
August 1st edition.
Yeah. The statistics on that are kind of interesting. What do they have? The circa of what, 1.5 million?
Yes.
But that's mostly by subscription, like the vast majority is by subscription, which isn't – so all this controversy is going to influence that. Yeah. They sell, what, 75,000 copies nationwide?
On newsstands.
Yeah.
So we'll know if there's a blip. Yeah, they'll sell out, and it probably will help. There'll be people who will feel obligated just to make a statement of First Amendment rights to go out and buy it.
One of our local firms is taking some grief on social media. I think it's Price Chopper was taking some grief yesterday because they decided that they were going to carry it because they believe, according to what they posted, they believe in free speech.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it is, I think, somewhat hypocritical of CVS and Walgreens. You could probably buy a lot more racier covers and a lot of covers that would be objectionable to people for all kinds of reasons. And it's just politically, I think, motivated to come out and be so high and mighty.
But, it also may avoid the harder decision, which may be, you know, that somebody on their board, somebody was yelling, we don't want to sell it anymore in the, you know, any of them. So we'll just ban this one edition, and that gets them off the hook.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it was a convenient response. Now, the social media response to the cover, I think, is different. I'm kind of surprised. I mean, there were probably a lot of covers over the years. We ran a gallery yesterday of controversial covers on our website, still there.
Could you get it at TimesUnion.com?
Yes, we did. Oh. Yeah. But the point was that, you know, there's always been controversial covers. You know, you think of the Demi Moore when she was pregnant.
And Vanity Fair, Annie Leibovitz, right?
Right. All kinds. They're good talking points. They draw a lot of attention. I mean, maybe Rolling Stone has achieved what it wanted by this. It caused somewhat level of controversy and people are talking about it.
Well, they're not stupid people. They probably had some inkling what what kind, maybe not the the level of ire, but
I find it amusing because everyone see, and there he is in an Armani shirt.
Yeah,
I was like, okay,
again. He was a terrorist before, but I, now that I see he's wearing an Armani,
Armani shirt, well, that,
now I like him.
That certainly yeah. says a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I think people are very superficial who are complaining about this. I mean, I think that...
And haven't read the article.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's... Right. Okay. I mean, and
what you pointed out a moment ago is a really long article.
Yeah, I haven't
you
read it all either.
You've got to slog through that. I mean, it's good, but it is... It's
the part
really,
I read was
really
good. And I'll read the rest over the weekend, maybe.
But back to the, we'll move on to another aspect of the story in a second, but, both, Walgreens and CVS, one of the stores, and I believe it was CVS, said that, that they felt they had a moral imperative not to sell the, to sell the magazine. And I thought, well, because people would be offended by it, well, people would be offended by contraceptives as well, but you sell those.
Or cigarettes.
Or cigarettes,
and
right.
And when you go into my CVS, which I love, in Little Great Barrington, there's always all of the women's magazines. And on the left-hand side of every women's magazine at the top, it always says the same thing. It always says, better sex, the best sex yet, how to please your man, how to please your woman, how to do this or that.
Yeah, but I mean, not with a terrorist.
I find that offensive, to tell you the truth. Well, very offensive.
So someone else who finds it offensive was a police officer in Boston who said, this is not how this man should be portrayed. This is not how we feel he should be viewed by the public. So U.S. police photographer leaked two images of Boston Marathon suspect Shokhar Tsarnaev during his capture. And they're very graphic. Very graphic images of a man who is bloodied, who has a laser on his on the center of his head from the sniper's rifle on his face, and it is a very disturbing photograph right next to the boat in which he was hiding out in for a long period of time. And I believe there was another picture as well, which I think was just of him in the boat, right? Mm. So those pictures came out and are being widely circulated. I don't know.
I think those are important photos. It's kind of interesting that they weren't made public before. I think they tell a story. I think they have enormous journalistic value. They show what it was like the night that he was captured, which was pretty dramatic.
Yeah. And he was taken, it was, the photos were taken as part of the investigation, right? Mm-hmm. So they would not normally be released, I guess, but, or they could be.
Well, now, Mike, you help run a major organization, and you have rules in your organization. How would you feel if, one of your people let something out before you were ready to run with a story or something like that? Would you be angry about that?
It's in the new world of multimedia, that kind of thing happens. A photographer gets a great shot. We don't wait till tomorrow's front page to run it.
We don't wait. You've made that decision. Yeah. The minute you say we don't wait, but let's say the person who works for you makes the decision to go ahead with that without your approval.
Well, I think we encourage that kind of unilateral decision making. If a reporter is out at a scene and he takes with his smartphone takes a picture, he'll tweet it. You know, we want people to get the word out. Mm-hmm. We're kind of default on the side of disclosure. So I don't know that that's it. Yeah, if you're talking about taste, running a picture of a guy that's
bloody. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about we all assume that the leakers are good. Frankly, that's where I come from. To tell you the truth, there's always organizations and they always have rules. And I think that it's one thing to say, okay, we encourage tweeting and the rest of it. But let's just for the hell of it say, we're talking about a major story that involves the Hearst Corporation and that somebody picked up a piece of paper in the, off somebody's desk and went ahead and did that. You, you guys might not be pleased, right?
Oh, we not every story is favorable to us, but we run on favorable stories. If somebody sues us or somebody criticizes us, you know.
He's trying to say that somebody takes a private memo off somebody's desk and it becomes...
All right, so here's an example that's making the news. J.K. Rowling.
Okay.
J.K. Rowling writes the Harry Potter novels. She writes these novels, and they're the biggest thing, and she's the richest woman in the world.
Except for Queen Elizabeth.
Okay. So she writes a novel, and she puts it out under a pseudonym. And she puts it out into the world called The Cuckoo's Calling. And it, you know, it doesn't sell very well. It sells okay, but it's not a big deal.
Not that good. 1,500 copies, I think, I read.
Yeah.
Not a lot.
Yeah, not a lot. So not huge distribution. And so then the lawyer says, well, let me tweet out that it was indeed J.K. Rowling.
Whose lawyer? Her lawyer?
Their law firm.
Yeah, a law firm that represents her. Actually, it's not that direct. It was somebody in the law firm.
One of the partners.
Told his wife, who told a friend, and she tweeted it. Isn't that the connection? It's like...
It's
the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon thing. It's kind of a little more. It's not actually the attorney who represents her who leaked it.
Chris Gossage, who is the attorney, gave the information to the best friend, Judith Caligari.
There you are.
Who was behind the tweet. That Twitter account has now been deleted, and I'm sure she is. She's been duly taken care of.
On the other hand, they can't.
And one of the characters from Harry Potter is deleting her. Harry Potter.
Right. Yeah,
and on the other hand, they can't find enough books. Every bookstore wants them. There's advanced sales and all the rest. So it leads, at least to my kind of cynical mind, the idea that maybe they knew what they were doing.
Well, there is the notion that if it's...
Well, she's upset.
Right.
She's upset?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she's suing. She's upset. I mean, because she did this because she didn't want it to be known.
She didn't want it to be successful or fail because of her name.
Right.
She wanted it to, whatever happened to it, she wanted it to be.
Do you have a lot of sympathy for her about that?
The successor, I mean, because she got outed?
Yeah.
I have sympathy for her that if she went through if you want to go through an artistic endeavor and you want your anonymity and you have worked out an agreement with both your law firm as well as your publisher, and then someone within that equation destroys that.
It.
Yes, I do feel bad for her.
Well, I don't. And who,
why, just because she's making money? Because she's rich?
No, not at all. I mean, I think you guys are, semi-hypocritical. You sit around here and you talk about how leaking is so important, and we have to have more leaking, and we have to have more whistleblowing.
I believe you said that. I think we ever said that. I think you said that.
So I'm sympathetic, but go ahead.
I have a lot of more things to worry about than whether or not she got out of it.
I think that would characterize my feelings.
This is not an actual.
Now, Joe, who is she suing?
She'll sue the law firm. I mean, it would be a breach of confidentiality if your lawyer outed you, you know, and
if your lawyer did it purposely or whatever.
Even accidentally, negligently. It's probably malpractice.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that is part of the thing of a lawyer, right? They're supposed to take your information and keep quiet. So if you're a lawyer, so if you tell something to your lawyer in confidence and then they spill the beans makes it to the front page of the paper, you wouldn't be ticked off?
Okay, let me just say, you're absolutely right. I'm still not at all sympathetic.
Yeah, and we can blame a lawyer in this. This makes it easy.
No brainer. Carry the one.
You're going to get a few phone calls. Because I know members of your family.
Yeah, I know.
Mike Spain, Paul Conte, and Alan Chartok are with us. We are talking about a variety of issues. We'll continue our discussion and welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Capcom Federal Credit Union, offering home mortgages, auto loans, checking, financial planning, and more. CapcomFCU.org. Express Pediatrics Highland. Walk-in urgent care for children. Open Monday through Friday from 5 p.m. to midnight. Weekends, noon to midnight. ExpressPediatrics.com. The Hyde Collection. Presenting Modern Nature, Georgia O'Keeffe and Lake George. Featuring 58 paintings on view, produced during the years O'Keeffe lived in the Southern Adirondacks, now through September 15th. HydeCollection.org. And Mohawk Trail Concerts Summer Festival. Featuring flute sonatas from Poulenc and Mendelssohn and a piano quartet. Today and tomorrow at the Federated Church in Charlemont, MohawkTrailConcerts.org.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. We have a few more minutes before we wrap up for this week, and we end with an education story out of Cobleskill and concern over the graduation rates at the State College at Cobleskill.
Yeah, Scott Waldman, our education writer, has a column today about a trial that he's been covering. It's in federal court. It has to do with a whistleblowing case where a dean, a former dean now at Cobleskill, the State University College at Cobleskill in Schoharie County, calls the college essentially, in Scott's interpretation, a dropout factory that lures subpar students to help it meet the bottom line. It asserts in this trial that where this gentleman, Thomas Hickey, a former arts and sciences dean at Cobleskill, accuses the school of, cutting his role, cutting his pay, and he wants to get that back, but he also wants to see changes at the school, and he wants to be reinstated to his position. He's accusing them of deliberately luring in students who get loan money and federal grants so that they can fill the classrooms, pay the bills. In fact, evidence in the trial says that the former vice president for academic affairs wrote a number of emails in which she said that she would lower academic standards to keep students enrolled because the school had to pay bills. That's quite an indictment. It's one school, but there are people that say that admission standards and other standards at colleges have gone too low. What do you academics think, Paul and Alan?
Well, I can tell you that I taught for one very short year before I went to New Paltz at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice at CUNY. And at that point, there was an open enrollment program, meaning anybody could come. But then there was the concept of could you fail anybody? And as I remember it, you weren't allowed to fail. You were allowed to withdraw somebody from your course, but people couldn't fail. Along comes Herman Badillo and a new chancellor at the City University, and they turn everything around. And people have to achieve. When I got into Hunter, I think you needed an 85 average from high school in order to go to the City University. Then comes the idea that those people who have been at the lower end of the SES socioeconomic spectrum are penalized, that a great state or city university should take everybody and everybody should have a chance to do well. But then what happens is that somebody will yell, okay, you set us up to fail. I remember that very well. So we take everybody, but you're going to kick us out now, so you didn't do the right kind of remedial work and the rest. It's really quite a sophisticated set of arguments on all sides.
Just out of curiosity, what is I'm sorry, I was way back there when I said that.
That's all right. It's a microphone.
What's this electronic thing that we're doing here?
Broadcasting.
We know that that's what the whistleblower is maintaining. My guess is Cobleskill isn't maintaining. That's not what Cobleskill is saying.
Right. They're saying that this guy, Thomas Hickey, is disgruntled.
Yes.
And he didn't get along with people, et cetera, okay, et cetera. They also say that the college was offering a great opportunity to disadvantaged people. Some of them would be the first in their families to attend college, and a percentage of those those will fall out, but some of them will succeed, and they'll be the enablers of that. And that is their defense. And they say that it's a reality that colleges will take in large numbers, especially if they have open admissions. I mean, the alternative is to have a very, very high standard and have very few students, and that way you can keep
and only to serve a segment of the population. That's
right.
Really
correct.
What it comes down to.
Yeah, right. Sure, exclusivity, right. Mm-hmm. So, but it
would be bad if what the whistleblower is alleging is what the college was doing. I don't, you know, it's as you get into these things, it's hardly ever as cut and dried as it is sometimes maintained in an argument, especially in a courtroom. Right. It's usually somewhere in the middle. I don't think colleges should be in a position where, you know, you're just lowest unit rate. You're diving down to scoop up just to get money in.
Well, it's interesting this year. Albany Law School has deliberately reduced the number of students they're going to take in to try to elevate the standards. And one of the issues, of course, is that there's fewer jobs for attorneys in this economy, and there's a lot of shifting going on in the whole legal industry. But the other argument for doing it is that they can focus on a smaller group. Like you were saying, Alan, you know, it serves only a segment.
I'm fascinated, by the way, what Paul or you, I'm not quite here, said, which
you can both take credit for this. Congratulations.
Which was,
if we want to.
I think it was you, Mike, that the dean or the academic vice president had put it on paper.
Yeah, that would be bad.
First rule of public administration, never put it on paper.
you mean they can get my emails?
How does that happen? But if you leak it, it's okay.
Yeah. Well, you're really pushing all the buttons here, Joe.
have to use a megaphone, but not put it on paper.
If they're extending opportunities to people who are marginally qualified, but perhaps they have methods of...
They offer remedial programs. That's another argument that they will give students who would have not otherwise gone to college.
And a lot of colleges do that,
by
the way,
yes.
Including the College of St. Rose.
Right. I think colleges have done that for decades. I mean, it's...
On the other hand, when I went to New Paltz in 1971 full-time, as a professor, that is, Paul is smiling, it was very easy to get into the place. I mean, in fact, we used to say that if you held a mirror up into somebody's face and you got a breath, you know, they were admitted. Nevertheless, this is now the single most exclusive school, I think, in the state university. Sometimes it goes back and forth between Binghamton and New Paltz. And let me tell you, SUNY at New Paltz is now regarded as a great success story.
It has a great reputation.
Yes, and that is because the admissions policies and everything else have gotten tougher.
Well, once you set a limit on how many you're going to accept and you become successful, there is selection that goes on then. And
yes,
it does raise it.
Yes, Paul, but I'm not – but the argument here – is that if a college like the one we're discussing allows everybody to come in just so that there is no social preference and no status preference, that it's a good college for that reason. Whereas I'm saying the generally accepted norm here is the more selective it is, the better it is. And at least this discussion allows us to get that on the table.
Well, I'm sorry. Yeah. We're out of time.
Sure. Okay.
Because in just seconds, British people are going to start talking. So my thanks to everyone. Have a great weekend. Thank you very much. We'll see you all next week, and we look forward to that. The roundtable continues.